The next case is Smith versus Barnhart, 04-14-33. Mr. Duncan?
Yes. May it please the court, counsel. Justices, the primary
judges. We're not on the Supremes.
Sorry. The primary issue in this case is the circumstances which resulted in the action by the appeals counsel. Secondary is the actions of the administrative law judge at the hearing stage. The first issue and the most important issue is whether the appeals counsel violated the plaintiff's right to counsel and the right to be heard. The district court in this case, and I understand that this court has de novo review, the district court ruled that there was a harmless error standard in this particular case, which does not apply in the Seventh Circuit. Specifically, I would point to the fact that the standard of review the Seventh Circuit generally applies and the standard of review for the appeals counsel are two separate issues. In a particular case, the appeals counsel has a de novo review function, especially when new evidence is presented at the time of the filing of the briefs. What we have in this particular case is a situation where counsel for the claimant at the time of the hearing filed the appropriate appeal papers, but then notified the defendant, or excuse me, the claimant, that he was going to have to withdraw as a result of his conflict of interest involving another individual in the claimant's family. Counsel then was approached toward the end of the filing deadline, did not have a file, did not have any paperwork, and requested a continuance or extension of time to obtain the paperwork and obtain medical records. Counsel at the hearing phase did not obtain up-to-date medical records. When the file was originally brought up at the reconsideration phase, which predates the administrative law phase, that was the last time medical records were ordered. No medical records were ordered between that time, over 1 year in time, and the time of the hearing. Those records are requested. I can only speak to the court based on the fact that I regularly handle appeal and regularly handle cases at the hearing stage before administrative law judges. On the average, I receive between 90 and 100 decisions from the Social Security Administration per year, and I regularly appear both in the Western District and I believe this is now my sixth oral argument for this court on Social Security matters. I can honestly say that the appeals counsel has, in essence, made an error. They ignored a request and now are attempting to hide behind the regulations to justify their error.
But this additional evidence that you wanted to present related, you know, how does it relate to the period on or before the ALJ's decision? And one of the questions I have is, why can't Mr. Smith file a new application for benefits on the basis of this new evidence, since nearly all of it post-dates the ALJ's decision?
Well, first of all, because from the date of the ALJ's decision back to his onset date, the date he alleged he became disabled, he would be precluded under res judicata from receiving any benefits for that period of time. So he would lose back wages of approximately 2 years. Second, that would also, because of the fact that the onset date dictates when someone is eligible for Medicare benefits, he would have an additional 24-month waiting period before he would be eligible for Medicare. And as far as the issue laid out by you, Judge, the issue is that under the standard of review, under the regulation, when new evidence is filed, the appeals counsel is not charged with determining whether this is just new evidence or whether it alters the opinion of the ALJ or whatever. Instead, the standard literally is, according to both the regulation 404.970B, and the HELOCS, which is the internal document that Social Security uses to determine how they handle these cases, that any new evidence requires the counsel to evaluate the entire record. That means that the findings of the ALJ will not be looked at per se, but will be given a de novo hearing. Now, this is a very important issue, and the reason why I'm saying this is an important issue is that according to the statistics released by the Social Security Administration for the year 2003, cases at the Appeals Council level, 70% of those cases were denied on appeal. As a practitioner who regularly appears, my success rate in those cases has been more like 75%. So in this particular case, and it's a lot based upon the fact of post-decision development of the record for the Appeals Council. So to be denied the right to present new evidence at the Appeals Council level is not just a single minuscule little piece of the law that would not directly affect my client's benefits, but it's just to the contrary. A very significant issue, a very significant piece, and again, I would point to the fact that the counsel made an error. I know in their brief.
Isn't your argument hurt by the fact that no records were submitted in the 6-month period between your letter to the Appeals Council requesting additional time and the counsel's decision denying review?
No, and I will tell you why, Judge. And that is because I have had these kinds of cases on 3 different occasions. The Appeals Council has thousands of files. If a file is not in a particular slot, in a room, in Falls Church, Virginia, anything that is submitted to that agency may not make its way into the file itself. If you send in something before they acknowledge or notify you, you are running a risk of it ever being included in the document.
And I appreciate that's kind of anecdotal and not in the record and sort of your experience, but the bottom line is none were submitted during that period.
No, but the records were submitted, well, there was nothing to submit because no reply was ever given by the Appeals Council. The Appeals Council waited for almost a year after the request to even issue a statement saying yes, no, or... In this case, never did anything, just immediately denied the just indicated that they never even acknowledged receipt of the request.
The Appeals Council was under no obligation to grant a second extension of time for submission of the new evidence, was it?
No, they're not under any obligation to do so, except that under extraordinary circumstances. And that's the way the law is written, Judge Sykes. And my understanding of extraordinary circumstances would be pretty much, I think, in this particular case, when the attorney of record indicates he has to withdraw because of a conflict of interest under the ethics rules in the state of Wisconsin, and new counsel comes in the day before the expiration of the hearing date, I will argue that that's extraordinary circumstance.
But there's no established right to counsel at this level, is there?
Well, there's no case law one way or the other that says that there is. Although at this level, an individual is allowed to file a brief, add new evidence, and new documentation, and the advice or the assistance of counsel is generally implied at this stage.
So are you suggesting that before the Appeals Council could ever make a ruling, it would need to, you know, look into the status of counsel and whether or not there was representation and issues like that?
No. What I'm arguing, Judge Williams, is that when they are notified that there is a change of counsel, and the form is a 1696 U4 form, appointment of representative, it's the only form that Social Security recognizes. When one of these is sent to them saying there's a change of counsel, they are obligated and under guidelines to at least acknowledge that, and failure to do so is an error on their part requiring a remand.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. or Mrs. Beverly? All right.
May it please the court, I'm Catherine Beverly on behalf of the defendants. Your Honor, I'd like to address the arguments that counsel has raised with respect to the appeals counsel's review of this additional evidence that was never submitted. The appeals counsel does, the regulations do provide that the appeals counsel will review new and material evidence. It does not state that anything that is submitted is automatically going to be considered. And what's critical in this case is that the evidence which was actually submitted postdated the ALJ's decision by quite a significant amount of time. So even if the appeals counsel should have acknowledged the fact that counsel had sent in a letter stating that the prior attorney had a conflict of interest, there's no showing that the evidence that he would have submitted would have met the appeals counsel's requirements. And I think that's critically important in this case. The other point I'd like to make is that is one which you, Judge Williams, raised, is the fact that he did have the opportunity to present additional evidence to the appeals counsel, and it's not the fact that he did not receive a second extension of time to submit the additional evidence does not result in him suffering some kind of constitutional harm. With respect to the counsel's argument on the request for a sentence 6 remand, again, the evidence which he submitted does not meet those requirements either. The evidence is not new with respect to the records from his former employer. Those records were offered well in advance of the ALJ's decision and could have been presented to the ALJ by the first attorney. The other evidence, which was additional evidence reflecting on his mental impairments and some on his physical impairments, that was all covering the period from January 2002 until August 2003. And here, the ALJ's decision was December 12, 2000. So we're not looking at records that are time relevant. And there's nothing to suggest that Mr. Schmidt would be precluded from filing an application for benefits, a new application for benefits in this case. And then if I could just talk very briefly about the arguments that counsel raised with respect to the ALJ's credibility determination. The ALJ here did take a multi-factored approach in looking at whether Mr. Smith's allegations were supported by the record. He considered the objective medical evidence, which was a proper consideration. He laid out evidence showing that although he complained of back pain, there was no current treatment. He was not taking any prescription pain medication. He went on to discuss the daily activities, stating that they were not significantly restricted. The record supports that finding. Mr. Schmidt, in his activity report, indicated that he worked on the computer. He watched 5 to 6 hours of television a day. He wrote stories. He worked on a gemstone hobby. He mowed the lawn. He's visiting friends several times a week. And he also admitted that his mother relied on him to perform heavy household chores, such as yard work, home repair, and snow removal. And those are all activities which militate against the finding that his back condition or shoulder condition would prevent him from performing the light work, which the ALJ found was appropriate here. The ALJ also looked at the extensive work activity which was present in this case. Although Mr. Schmidt alleged that he became disabled in December 1998, he did begin working in 2000 for, I believe, a 7 or 8 month period of time. The ALJ considered that as evidence militating against the claim of complete disability, and thereafter he also collected unemployment benefits. So we have an ALJ looking at all the relevant factors. He explained his reasoning as to why he was not finding the complaints fully credible, and those complaints are supported by substantial evidence. And so unless this court has any further questions, we would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
There are no further questions. Thank you, Ms. Beverly.
Thank you.
How much time does he have?
1 minute, counsel.
Taking up the last issue that counsel stated, and that's regards to the credibility, the issue of the computer and the mowing of the lawn and the household chores, counsel has cited post hoc rationalizations. These are not part of the ALJ's decision. It's not in the decision. This court has said repeatedly that you cannot rely on post hoc rationalizations, that it's the ALJ's duty to state and make support. Judge Williams was in the majority of the case in Clifford that I cited in my brief, which stated that the claimant's subjective complaints have to be supported by the medical signs and findings, and specifically
that the ALJ must, not the commission, not the counsel for commission, must state those. I would also point out that the issue of new application is and remains always a viable issue. But as I indicated, this forecloses Mr. Schmidt's opportunity to present additional evidence, and if the court does not grant this, it allows the commission's error to decide and to hide under the law.
Thank you, Mr. Duncan. The case will be taken under advisement.